It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 40 degrees. There's a light rain falling. Out at the airport, they are showing southerly winds at 5 miles per hour, and they have 10 miles of visibility. Look for rain between 4 and 10 p.m. today. Cloudy skies the whole time. Cloudy skies tonight, gradually becoming partly cloudy overnight, and we're looking for sunny skies tomorrow. West winds to 25, though, gusting as high as 30 tomorrow. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Oscar Dyson is out there surveying away. State lawmakers got some new details about the federal government's partial approval of the transportation plan they rejected earlier. And the Federal Emergency Management Agency has granted Wrangell residents the right to be compensated for lost subsistence foods. Plus, Juno is thinking about using some cruise ship money to clean up the cruise industry.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden is demanding Israel take new steps to protect civilians and aid workers in Gaza. NPR's Tamara Keith reports the White House says Biden spoke by phone today to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu days after seven food aid workers died in an Israeli strike.
After the call, White House National Security spokesman John Kirby said the U.S. expects that in the coming hours and days, Israel will announce new specific and concrete measures to get food to starving Palestinians in Gaza, to reduce the civilian bloodshed, and to protect aid workers. And it isn't just what's announced, but how it's implemented, he said.
If there's no changes to their policy and their approaches, then there's going to have to be changes to ours.
Kirby declined to preview what those changes might be, but the Biden administration has been under increased pressure to put conditions on arms shipments to Israel. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
Former President Donald Trump's campaign says it expects to raise $43 million at a fundraiser this weekend in Palm Beach. NPR's Frank Ordonez reports the number would break the record just set by President Biden's campaign in New York.
The Trump campaign is promising it'll be the largest amount for a Republican Party fundraiser by 100%. The former president has been keeping a relatively low profile since becoming the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party, but his team has been actively reshaping the Republican National Committee and ramping up fundraising. This week, the campaign announced that Trump and the RNC had raised more than $65 million in March alone. The Biden campaign has largely been outraising Trump, so a $40 million-plus fundraising haul will be compared to Biden's big night last week, where he was joined by former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton in New York City for a star-studded party that raised $26 million for the Biden campaign. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Trump lost two legal battles today. In Georgia's election interference case, a judge upheld a criminal indictment against Trump. And in Florida, a judge is declining to drop charges in Trump's classified documents case. No Labels, the group that was hoping to field a ticket for the 2024 presidential election, says it has failed to attract a viable candidate and is standing down. The group, which began in 2010 to promote bipartisanship and centrist politics, courted prominent Democrats and Republicans to run on its ticket. No Labels drew criticism from Democrats concerned that a third party run would hurt President Biden's reelection prospects.
This little life of mine.
Remembrances for the slain civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., killed on this day 26 years ago. Ceremonies were held in Memphis and in other cities to celebrate Dr. King's legacy. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration research vessel Oscar Dyson left its home port in Kodiak last week. The boat mostly provides insight into Alaska's fish populations, from the Gulf of Alaska to the Bering Sea. KMXT's Brian Benoit went aboard the ship before it left and has this report.
The Oscar Dyson was docked at Kodiak's Pier 2 as a thick fog rolled into town across Chiniak Bay on a Sunday afternoon. The research vessel is just over 200 feet long. Climbing up to the ship's wheelhouse is a bit of a walk. Terry McTighe is an ecologist for NOAA and the chief scientist on the boat's current research cruise, which runs through early April. She says a lot of the research revolves around trawl fisheries.
The big pollock surveys, those kind of things go out on this vessel.
McTighe says the ship has a 25-person crew, about half of whom are part of the NOAA Corps, which is an unarmed branch of federal uniformed officers. Lieutenant Benjamin Kaiser is a member of the NOAA Corps and is the ship's operations officer.
So the primary stuff that we do is all oriented around the Alaskan pollock fishery, specifically the Alaskan walleye surveys that go around in the Gulf of Alaska, on the western side, and also the Bering Sea.
Alaska's pollock fisheries are the state's largest by volume. Kaiser says NOAA recently finished the winter survey for the species, but unlike commercial trawlers, the Oscar Dyson does short mid-water net drags to get a snapshot of what's in the water. It helps verify what they see on sonar.
The scientists will be able to interpret it to see how much is below the ship on our current track line, and then basically, they have to ground truth that data.
Lieutenant Commander Emily Rose is also a member of the NOAA Corps and captains the Oscar Dyson. She says the research provides data used for fisheries management.
The pollock stuff that we do is very impactful directly as well, so it's kind of what we're used to doing, having things that directly impact the communities pretty quickly.
But for this cruise, they're also laying the groundwork to develop forecasting methods for harmful algal blooms, which are responsible for paralytic shellfish poisoning.
So it'll be fun. It'll be the first time we've done anything like this, and we're excited.
McTighe, the chief scientist, says they'll be taking mud samples from around Kodiak to find the root causes of the blooms. The ship will even host staff from the Kodiak Area Native Association to help the research.
So we're going to work over here, the bays along the coast of Kodiak, and then do lines that go all the way out on the continental shelf. Because this is our first year, and we don't know which of those samples are going to be reasonable.
They also have some stations to check in the Shalikov Strait on the west end of Kodiak Island. When they're out to sea, though, it's a 24-hour operation for nearly 2 weeks straight. McTighe says the crew has a unique approach to prevent burnout.
So we do 4 hours on, 8 hours off, 4 hours on, 8 hours off. So you would work, for instance, midnight to 4 a.m., noon to 4 p.m., and you'd have a gap of time where you can sleep and a gap of time where you can relax.
The NOAA research vessel is expected to return to Kodiak this weekend. Aboard the Oscar Dyson, I'm Brian Venois.
State lawmakers got some new details on Tuesday about the federal government's partial approval of a document outlining federally funded transportation projects. Alaska Public Media reports the Federal Highway Administration gave the go-ahead to a revised statewide transportation improvement program in late March after rejecting an earlier submission. But the partial in partial approval means there's a lot of work left to do, according to Transportation Commissioner Ryan Anderson, speaking to the House Transportation Committee on Tuesday.
We are ongoing with follow-ups at this time with Fed Highways. We'll be having a debrief next week with the Federal Highway Administration to continue on to some of the items that we have questions on with the partial approval as well.
Six of the more than 200 projects outlined in the planning document were excluded from approval. Federal officials flagged three projects that should have been included in the planning documents for local transportation planning groups but were not. Federal officials say other projects didn't have clear funding plans or were incorrectly grouped together. The Federal Highway Administration lists 6 pages of revisions to the planning process that must be made within the next 6 months. Additionally, Anderson says the state must provide more details on dozens of projects all across Alaska before they're approved. Even so, Anderson says the delays are not likely to bog down construction this summer.
We've awarded over $300 million in construction contracts, and that's you know, continuing work that's on the street that everyone will see out there this summer. So we haven't slowed down.
In another change, Anderson says projects that experience significant cost overruns will require approval by the federal government in the form of a formal amendment to the transportation plan. After the Federal Emergency Management Agency granted the Wrangell Cooperative Association individual assistance, the tribe received even more substantial news last week. Lost subsistence food can be reimbursed. KSTK's Colette Czarnecki has the story.
Following last November's catastrophic landslide, Tribal Administrator Esther Elsine Reese and other members took action.
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge that our community suffered a devastating loss and it impacted each and every one of us. We were trying through the FEMA assistance to provide just a little help for the community members and those that were impacted.
The tribe pushed for subsistence to be included in the emergency declaration assistance. Reese says in the past, freezers and other appliances could be replaced, but subsistence foods could not. But that's changed. Early last week, Reese and council members received the news through an email.
And then I read it, and I was just, like, dancing around. We had council members there. Everyone was so excited. We were giving high fives.
The FEMA email said that subsistence foods were accepted to be included in the individual assistance.
We were so excited that this addition was approved. The importance of traditional subsistence foods runs very deep for our people. The peoples of the Shtikine Kwan have stewarded and depended on our lands for subsistence for thousands of years. And we depend on traditional subsistence foods for their cultural importance.
Many residents also depend on subsistence foods as an economic factor because food and living are significantly high in Wrangell.
If freezers full of subsistence foods are lost due to a natural disaster, it is the equivalent of the loss of a grocery store in remote rural areas. We realized this importance and requested that FEMA add traditional subsistence foods as something that is covered after a natural disaster.
Subsistence food in Wrangell could be a freezer full of moose, venison, salmon, berries, and other traditional foods. Reese grew up eating subsistence foods in cake, Kikkwan, on Kuppernauf Island.
One of my favorite memories was eating salmon cooked in skunk cabbage leaves on the coals of a fire and eating herring eggs with seal grease. And it just brings up the sense of how our traditional foods are our connection to our culture, they're our connection to our land, and they're our connection to our ancestors.
The executive order that the Biden administration advanced acknowledges that tribal governments bring expertise in the needs of their citizens and in stewarding their lands. FEMA will be in Wrangell during April to assist residents with applying for individual assistance. Natalie Shaver is a public affairs specialist with FEMA.
I do want to remind people that even though we don't have that in-person location at the moment, we do have an Alaska-specific hotline because we do know the needs of Alaskans are very different than maybe the rest of the country.
Shaver recommends that most people apply for assistance, even if their houses weren't destroyed. Things that the assistance could cover include grants for home repairs, temporary rental assistance, vehicles of damaged and essential personal property.
There's also potentially money for loss of subsistence items. Other things that people might think about that could potentially be covered could be medical, dental, and funeral expenses caused by the disaster as well.
Shaver says that FEMA cannot duplicate funds, meaning if the state already covered something, they cannot cover that same item. She says there's a public assistance side, too, where the federal government pays 75% of the cost and the tribe pays 25%. These can go to disaster expenses like damaged infrastructure and public facilities. Lastly, a hazard mitigation grant program is included in the disaster declaration.
Grant funding is something that the tribe can use that will help protect against future hazards. And they don't have to be necessarily related to a landslide. It can be any kind of threat that poses risk.
This could be a wildfire, flooding, or something different from what has already been experienced. In Wrangell, I'm Colette Czarnecki.
Each year, Juno divvies up millions of dollars collected from cruise passengers for projects that support the local tourism industry. This year, one proposed project would set money aside to help the city's tourism businesses cut down on polluting fossil fuel in their planes, buses, and boats.
The proposal would set aside $1 million collected via marine passenger fees to fund a new clean energy loan program. City tourism manager Alex Pierce says the visitor industry generates a lot of Juneau's greenhouse gas emissions. She said she's heard from residents and business owners who hope to cut down on pollution, but there needs to be incentives to speed the transition to cleaner power.
What I keep hearing consistently is that operators are interested and that it's just cost prohibitive.
Public businesses or governments are often eligible for money that helps them to cut down on their emissions. Juneau, for instance, received funding from the Federal Transportation Administration to buy their electric buses. But private tourism businesses are often excluded from those grant programs. Bob Jans, owner of the whale-watching and hiking company Gastineau Guiding, has 30 diesel buses he'd like to replace. But he says it's hard for small companies to scale up.
We can dabble here and there in the market, but until we really go into it full speed ahead, the impact is not much. Well, full speed ahead is a lot of money, but this grant program would hopefully make that possible for us.
Pierce says there's a precedent for a loan program like this. In the early 2000s, the city established a loan fund that helped companies to buy quieter engines for their float planes. The new clean energy program uses that as a model. At this stage, what qualifies as clean energy is unclear. Bottom line, it's something that will cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. Pierce says that could extend to things like hydropower or even things like biodiesel. She points to Holland America in Juneau. Last summer, they started using fuel developed from cooking oil to supplement the diesel that powers some of their buses. They claim that it can cut emissions by 10%.
I don't want to unnecessarily limit operators, you know, maybe a smaller operator that wants to replace like a dirty old school bus with just a brand new clean diesel bus. That's a really big move in terms of emissions reduction.
But Jans hopes the program will eventually push the local tourism industry towards net zero emissions through electrification, which would tap into the city's hydropower supply.
If I live long enough to see our fleet converted to electric, both on our boats and with our buses, I will be the happiest person in the world.
The city is also considering a move towards further electrification of cruise ship docks. $5 million for shore power is up for consideration in the marine passenger fee budget. Though both proposals are in their preliminary stages, they'll be up for debate as the city budget discussions begin this weekend. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Kenai Peninsula College is currently offering a Native beadwork traditions course. It teaches a number of beading techniques while helping students better understand Native culture. KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports.
But I've been doing beadwork for years with my aunt, and actually beading is what got me started with doing my own language. So beading has always been healing for me.
In a classroom in the college's Brockle building, instructor Sandra Shaganoff Stewart tells a group of six students about her experiences with Native beadwork.
Whenever I've ever wanted to, you know, like get into learning about something or learning about my culture or even writing, when I was doing my dissertation for my master's, I had to do beadwork along with it because it helped calm me down. And I never realized how powerful this is to me.
The class will learn beading techniques in a similar way to how Shaganoff Stewart was taught. She learned how to bead from her aunt, Catherine Wade, the clan grandmother of the Chickaloon Native Village.
She taught me beading when I had curiosity about trying to get back to my culture, learning about my language. She formed learning language around learning about beading. So she would talk to me at her breakfast table. She set the tone of thinking good for who you're making it for, even if it's for yourself.
I did it very slowly because mine got knotted too. And so then I would just put another one right over it.
After a round of classroom introduction, Students begin learning the fundamentals of threading and knotting by creating a basic necklace. A table in the center of the classroom displays what's to come, from brick stitch earrings to beaded flower patterns on gloves. Students can work with a variety of bead types, from bone beads to locally sourced devil's club. There are numerous colors to choose from, each with their own cultural significance.
You know, when you bead, you gotta always think good. You have to think good in your mind, because whatever you're making, you're putting that energy into it. So it's just like cooking.
Brittany Belts is a student of the course who's always had an interest in Native beadwork. She was briefly taught the tradition as a child, but didn't consider relearning it until marrying a Native man and having children.
I've always been kind of crafty and always loved learning new things about the state that I now made my home. So it's just being able to relate to my kids better and be able to teach them the way I was taught, whether it's in a class or from a family setting. It's a sense of community.
Belts says the course provides firsthand experience that can't be taught from an online video. Like Belts, other students have ties to Native culture. Although she's taught several Alaska Native cultural skills at the college, this is the first time Shaganoff Stewart has ever taught beading in a classroom setting. She hopes the students will share their new skills with others to keep the Native tradition alive.
My Aunt Katie always told me, she says, I'm sharing this with you, and I want you to then share it with somebody else so it continues on. And so I've always thought about whatever I have learned, I want to share it to the next person, because you never know where that's going to lead to. So for me, learning about beads is always healing. It's learning about yourself and also coming together as a community.
Registration for the 3-week-long Native Beadwork Traditions course is still open. For more information about the course or to register, contact Kenai Peninsula College. In Soldotna, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Another skirmish over government transparency and dueling authorities is heating up between the Anchorage Assembly and Mayor Dave Bronson, as reported by Alaska Public Media. In the latest exchange, the Assembly adopted a resolution last week to subpoena an agreement that the administration signed in October without the Assembly's or the public's involvement. And then today, and then on Tuesday, the mayor vetoed that resolution. The agreement has to do with the future of rights to water that collects in Aklutna Lake, the source of nearly all of the city's drinking water. In his veto letter, Bronson said his administration had already privately shared and discussed the agreement with the Assembly, but maintains that it is confidential and cannot be made public without opening up the city to a breach of contract lawsuit with the other parties to the agreement. Bronson suggested that the Assembly is wasting taxpayer money and said the Assembly was using, quote, scare tactics to bully municipal employees. Last week, Assembly Vice Chair Meg Zalatel gave two reasons for subpoenaing the agreement. One, so the Assembly could share a copy with its own lawyers working on a possible lawsuit against the administration for ignoring the city's official policy on the future of the Aklutna River. And two, so the Assembly and its lawyers could discuss potential public disclosure of the agreement without the administration's lawyers in the room. Zalatel, an attorney herself, said she heard the municipal attorney's reasoning for why it should stay confidential.
I don't feel like it's sufficient, especially since prior agreements around how we access water, the 1984 agreement, was a public document and subject to our approval. I believe we need to be transparent about it.
Assemblymember Karen Bronga was one of four members to vote against the subpoena resolution.
This sort of seems like chest puffing to subpoena people to come in. I'm not feeling good about that.
With 8 members voting yes last week, the Assembly appears to have the supermajority to override the mayor's veto. Bronson announced his veto on the city's election day. He is running for a second term in office. Akutan is slated to receive a fiber optic internet connection this summer through the GCI Aleutians Fiber Project. Construction is complete, and all that's left is to test the system. That's according to a statement put out on Tuesday from the Alaska-based telecommunications company. Once a connection is established, Accutan will become the fourth Aleutian community linked to subsea fiber optic network. Unalaska, Sandpoint, and King Cove are already connected. Next, crews will move into the remote communities of Chignik Bay and Larsen Bay. When they've connected those communities to the fiber optic network, the project's first phase will be complete. GCI project manager Jerry Walker noted the challenges of constructing in places only accessible by boat or airplane, like Chignik Bay and Larsen Bay. He said, quote, "You can't just drive to the store for a forgotten piece of material. Every detail must be planned and accounted for before we start work," end quote. Planning for the fiber optic project started in 2017. The overall cost will be about $100 million, about half of which comes from federal grant programs.
Another crackdown on password sharing. I'm Novosavo with the Marketplace Minute. Disney CEO Bob Iger tells CNBC that the company's streaming service will begin cracking down starting in June. Iger is under pressure to improve profit margins. He beat back an activist investor challenge at the company's annual shareholder meeting yesterday. Alaska Airlines says it received $160 million in compensation from Boeing during the first 3 months of the year. The airline expects more compensation for lost profits. An Alaska-operated Boeing MAX jet lost a door plug mid-flight in January. All MAX planes were temporarily grounded. The band Kiss has sold its catalog in a deal estimated to be worth more than $300 million. The buyer is the virtual concert creator Pop House Entertainment. I'm Novosavo with a Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Thursday. It is the fourth day of April, the year 2024. The sun rose today at 7:27. It will set again at 8:58, which will give us 13 hours and 31 minutes of daylight, an anagram, a gain of 4 minutes and 59 seconds. Our record high temperature for this date was 54 degrees, set in 1941, and our record low was 12 degrees, set in 1949. Currently 40 degrees, a light rain is drifting down, southerly wind at 5 miles per hour out at the airport where they are also experiencing 10 full miles of visibility. Rain is likely this afternoon, mostly after 5 p.m. It's expected to continue until about 11 p.m. tonight. Cloudy skies otherwise, but those cloudy skies are expected to gradually become partly cloudy and then clear up by tomorrow. Look for an overnight low of about 33, northwest winds to 20, gusting to 30 tonight, and look for them to turn to the west tomorrow and gust to 30 tomorrow as well. Sunny skies tomorrow, though, and mostly clear skies overnight on Friday. They are talking about a chance of snow for Saturday, followed by rain and snow, and snow for Saturday night. We have an outgoing tide. Our next low tide here on the east side will happen at 5:46 p.m. and be 0 feet, followed by a high tide at 12:25 a.m. just after midnight of 6.7 feet. Over on the west side, your low tide will happen at 6:19 p.m. and be 0.3 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 12:48 p.m. a.m. rather, of 12 feet. The following are upcoming Kodiak Island Borough public meetings.
On Tuesday, April 2nd at 5:30, the Women's Bay Service Area Board is having a regular meeting at the Women's Bay Fire Hall. Also on Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 o'clock, the Borough is having their Hazard Mitigation Plan meeting update via Zoom. On Thursday, April 4th at 6:30, the Borough Assembly is having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers.
All these meetings are open to the public, and the meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 for any questions.
With an increase in measles cases in the lower 48, now is a great time to make sure your family is up to date on protection against measles. Measles can be prevented with the MMR vaccine, and every child 1 year or older is eligible. Learn how to check your family immunization records and find locations to get vaccinated at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the Alaska Department of Health.
Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through tomorrow. Look for southwest winds to 25 knots, turning to the northwest tonight. 9-foot seas coming down to 7 feet tonight. And west winds to 25 knots tomorrow, seas to 7 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for tonight and Friday. Southwest winds to 20 knots today, seas to 5 feet. West 25 tonight and 6-foot seas. And west 30 tomorrow in the Shelikof with 6-foot seas. In Chiniak Bay, look for variable winds to 10 knots, turning to the east this afternoon with seas to 3 feet. For tonight, northwest winds to 20 knots and seas to 3 feet. And tomorrow in Chiniak Bay, west winds to 20 knots, seas to 3 feet. Up in Marmot Bay, small craft advisory for tomorrow. Southwest 10 today with seas to 2 feet. West 20 tonight with seas to 4 feet. And west 25 tomorrow with 4-foot seas tomorrow in Marmot Bay.
Don't miss the final concert of the Kodiak Arts Council's 2023-2024 season, Raybok, on Wednesday, April 10th at 7 p.m. in the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. One of Scotland's premier contemporary folk ensembles, Raybok blends their rich Highland and Island heritage with the vibrant musical landscape of Glasgow. With electrifying fiddles, pipes, vocals, and plenty of Scottish charm, Raybok is a show you didn't want to miss. Sponsored by Next Step Dance Kodiak. More information and tickets are available at kodiakarts.org.
That does sound good. The Kodiak Island Borough Assembly is having their regular meeting tonight at the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. Next Tuesday, the Service Area No. 1 Board will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And next Wednesday, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having a work session, also in the Borough Assembly Chambers, at 6:30 p.m. All these meetings are open to the public, and the packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. Things are happening tomorrow, the First Friday Art Walk, officially between 5 and 7 p.m., at multiple locations, including the Frame Shop. They will be featuring Jennifer Creelman Foster. The Kodiak Marketplace First Kiosk will feature Sally Troxel and Ingrid Rutzelainen. The Kodiak Island Brewery will feature Jane Robinson and Mark Witteveen, and the Aleutic Museum Store featuring Susan Malutin. The Kodiak History Museum will be featuring all the Kodiak High School Advanced Art Class, and Double Shovel Cider Company will be featuring Wild Designs Company. And after you've done all that, go to Call of the Wild, the newest addition to Galley Tables, also happening tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Kodiak Marketplace. Call of the Wild. Things happening at the Kodiak Public Library include today's edition of the Chess Club. They will be gathering at 3 p.m. today at the library. Canna's Elder Storytime is tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. And the animated movie Balto, highlighting the history of the Iditarod, will be shown on Friday. That's happening at 3:30 p.m. tomorrow. Runtime's about 78 minutes. It's rated G. And a special treat on Saturday, Cindy Lou Aylaud, author of Recess at 20 Below, will be at the library at 1 p.m. on Saturday. This event is sponsored by the Kodiak Island Borough School District.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
GCI is a participant in the Affordable Connectivity Program, providing qualifying Alaska households low-cost, entry-level broadband internet. More information at gci.com/ACP.
Energy Switch is the popular point-counterpoint show where two leading experts with different perspectives discuss the most pressing energy and climate issues in the news today. Coming up on Energy Switch, we'll talk about the benefits and challenges of electric cars.
Funding for Energy Switch was provided in part by the University of Texas at Austin and by EarthX.
Electric cars are quiet, fast, and efficient. You can fill them up in your garage overnight, and they produce no local emissions. But they're expensive, and their subsidies have gone mostly to the wealthy. And the critical minerals for their batteries are controlled by foreign powers, unless we begin more domestic mining. We'll look at all this and much more with my expert guests. Bea Spiller is a fellow at Resources for the Future, where she directs their transportation program. Before that, she was lead senior economist at Environmental Defense Fund.
It takes time for transformation. It takes time for the vehicle fleet to turn over. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's only 5%. That's really low economies of scale. And so prices are high, yes. As they learn and figure out new manufacturing processes, those costs will come down.
David Rapson is also an energy economist for the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and the Chancellor's Leadership Professor of Economics at the University of California, Davis.
If the goal of the electric vehicle revolution is to reduce transportation emissions, then it's not about getting electric vehicles on the road, it's about getting gasoline cars off the road.
I'm Scott Tinker, and I'm an energy scientist. In this episode of Energy Switch, Electric Cars, Pros and Cons, Part 1. So welcome, everybody. Really glad you're here with us. Most of us in the U.S. are driving gasoline cars or maybe diesel. Why do we care about EVs?
Well, EVs have a huge environmental benefit, right? They remove all tailpipe emissions from the road. And one of the biggest reasons why I think electric vehicles are so exciting is the potential for them to really reduce the harm that transportation pollution has on disadvantaged communities. These communities tend to live closer to highways and major roadways, as well as depots. And so if we begin to electrify that, we can start to improve the health and well-being of these communities who have been so historically damaged by transportation pollution.
A big environmental justice piece to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. David?
Well, the first thing I have to say, I work for the Federal Reserve, and so all of the opinions I have today are my own and not the Fed's. We care about electric vehicles because we care about climate change. You know, climate change is real. It's an urgent problem. And decarbonizing transportation is one of the most difficult aspects of that. And we have this technology that offers us a pathway where we decarbonize the grid and we switch from liquid fuels to electric vehicles. At least that's the vision.
Yeah. Let's start with kind of the market. How deeply have EVs penetrated the market so far, U.S. at least?
It's about 5.5%, and that's grown really rapidly over the past few years.
Right. U.S. sells about 15 million cars a year, so we're looking at...
It's about 750,000.
Approaching a million cars.
Absolutely,
EVs
yeah.
a year.
And we expect that number to go up a lot over the coming years.
Right.
You know, there really has been a rapid increase in the adoption of this technology.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's a very specific segment of the market that has taken off. Most of the consumers are very wealthy, and they're driving around cars that cost, you know, 60, 70, 80, sometimes thousand, you know, more dollars. So these are not inexpensive cars, and they're not accessible to the vast majority of the market at this point.
Yeah.
Well,
that's interesting.
Can I push back on that a
sure.
little bit? First of all, the great thing about Tesla was that they made these cars cool. Beforehand, everybody was thinking about these EVs as sort of horribly ugly, you know, lacking in horsepower, lacking in performance.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden, people are thinking about EVs as, wow, this is a really cool car. Mm-hmm. We can have environmentally friendly driving, but also have it be really fun to drive. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Prius is pretty ugly.
Interesting. Well, you know.
And that was
my kids are all beautiful.
Right.
But,
that was like the main way that people were able to, you know, improve the environmental impact of their driving.
How do we see that globally, EVs?
EVs have really taken off in China and in Europe. So in places where they want to signal that they're taking climate change seriously, electric vehicles are, you know, the pathway to signal that. I think it's worth noting, though, that even as they increase in the market share of new vehicles, it's a lot smaller as a share of the cars on the road. Right. And, you know, I think we're going to come back to this a few times, because if the goal of the electric vehicle revolution is to reduce transportation emissions, then it's not about getting electric vehicles on the road. It's about getting gasoline cars off the road.
That's interesting. In addition, China and the EU, China consumes 5 times more petroleum than it produces. So there's a practical driver here, too. We don't have oil. We need something else for our vehicles. And so it's climate, but it's also, particularly in China, really practical. Let's electrify this stuff, right?
Well, sure. But I mean, they're going to have to get inputs for electricity as well. So, you know, we saw what happened with Europe's electricity sector in 2022 when Russia cut off the flows of natural gas. You know, what happened to Germany as they shifted towards coal. And China is also importing a lot of coal and building a lot of coal-fired plants.
Correct. It's not good for climate, but it's good for transportation security.
That's exactly right. And if we as economists could, you know, wave our wand and do this efficiently, I think we'd have a lot more grid decarbonization happening before there's deep penetration of EVs in the market.
Interesting.
Because a lot, you know, our grid worldwide is about 60% fossil fuels. 40% of that is coal worldwide. And you flip those numbers in the U.S., we're about 60% fossil fuels on the electric grid in the U.S., where it's 40% natural gas, so it's a little bit cleaner. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, these cars have been branded, particularly in California, as zero emissions vehicles. And, you know, that's true at the tailpipe, but that's not true if what you care about is climate change.
Right. You agree?
The idea that we need to wait until the grid is decarbonized to make this transition, I think that's a fallacy. Because it takes time for transformation. It takes time for the vehicle fleet to turn over. Mm. Right now, it's only 5%. That's really low economies of scale. And so prices are high, yes. But as we push for more electric vehicles to come into the market, as they learn and figure out new manufacturing processes, those costs will come down. Another thing that I want to point out is there needs to be learning on the side of the customers, right? Mm-hmm. So understanding when's the right time to charge. How can we charge in a way that minimizes